The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly, where we might at some point talk about football. Leicester's stirring win at City, Chelsea crumbling and then grabbing a point at the Hawthorns, Man United winning at the death, Everton going joint top and West Ham going completely rogue, pulling out a 4-0 win over Wolves from nowhere. But we can't talk about the game when the game has gone. That's it. It's gone. Officially gone. Joel Ward, Eric Dyer and Neil Mopai after the game had finished. What happens inside IFAB? Is David Ellery there, rubbing his hands like a Bond villain? We know decision makers haven't played the game, but surely at some point in their life they've jumped in the air and noticed their arms don't just hang limply by their sides. Once we've solved that and done the Premier League, there's some big stories from Europe as Bayern are hammered and Suarez starts well. We'll answer your questions too, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, welcome back Barry Glendenning.
Hello Max, how are you?
I'm well. As I said to you a second ago, it's almost nice to see you. It's yeah. been so long.
No, I've had a nice week off. I defrosted my fridge. I opened an account with Spotify and I got a new doorbell.
Oh, wow. Could you after the pod play the doorbell and we'll have it as a secret track right at the end?
Yeah, I can actually. Yeah, I can do that.
Oh, great.
I had a selection of ring tunes I could have on the doorbell, so I was torn between dogs barking and the tune of Same Old Arsenal Always Cheating. So I've gone with the latter just because the dogs barking one is a bit too frightening.
From the Racing Post, the butter lover Mark Langdon joins us. Hey, Mark.
Oh, hi, Max. I can't follow that, actually. A very dull week for me. Oh,
that's okay. No week's going to be as exciting as defrosting the fridge and getting a new doorbell at the same time. Barney Ronne, how are you?
Yeah, all right, Max. How are you doing?
Yeah, really good, thank you. Are you up for this one?
Yeah, very much up for it. I've enjoyed the weekend as much as everyone else, which is probably not very much.
Excellent news. I put out on Twitter for questions and Paul said I would put my hand up and ask a question, but worried it could be a penalty. Padraig saying, if the game is gone, where exactly has it gone to and does it have to quarantine? So it was an interesting stat on Match of the Day 2 last night. The Premier League had 19 handball penalties last season. La Liga had 48 and Serie A had 57. So we'll try and do the handball decisions as one and then talk about the games themselves. Eric Dyer, Joel Ward, Neil Mopai. There's the sort of Kai Havertz one as well, where it does hit his hand in the build-up to Abraham's equaliser, but that wasn't given as a handball. I was really sad, and I was actually quite angry yesterday, Barney, and I'm not quick to anger, but I just found that so debilitatingly depressing at the end of the Spurs game.
Yeah, it's... I mean, the whole situation is bizarre. I mean, handball has been promoted from something really, really minor. It's an extra. It's nobody. It's in the side of the scene. And it's suddenly been placed centre stage and given a two-hour soliloquy as the most important thing in football. It's as though handball all these years has been this evil, hidden evil that must be stamped out. And we're finally digging in the culture wars. We finally turned our attention to handball. And people have been getting away with this for centuries. The Catholic Church, like, secretly handballing behind doors, like in their murderous little cabal. But finally, the whistleblowers have rooted out handball. And we all have to talk about handball endlessly, when in fact, handball simply exists to stop the game falling apart, to stop you from picking the ball up, to distinguish it from rugby. That's all handball is for. It's not, your hands are not evil. The hand striking a ball is not a terror. It's not like you're going to break someone's leg or some awful thing must be stopped. Hands are bad. But no, it's really important. And I mean, the one interesting thing about it is that I think it's really important to be clear that this is a matter of interpretation. We've chosen this. If you look at the rules, it all comes down to the phrase, how you interpret the phrase unnaturally bigger, which could be interpreted as something that only happens very, very rarely, or could be interpreted as something that happens all the time, which is what we've decided to do. So yeah, that if you simply possessing arms or having them by your side and not putting behind your back is unnaturally bigger, and therefore you are evil and must be penalised. I mean, it's absurd. You could stop this in 1 second by just saying, well, that's not unnaturally bigger. How do we want to interpret that? That's all it comes down to. And our referees have decided to interpret that as an incredibly punitive thing. And that's why we're having all these stupid discussions.
Yeah, if the ball strikes a player who has made their body unnaturally bigger, then they will be punished. It almost says punished by death. IFAB deems that an arm above the shoulder height is rarely, if ever, a natural position, with the only exception coming when a player is falling to the ground. The body also stated that extra leeway will be granted in regards to ricocheted handballs or if the player in question cannot see the ball. Barry, Eric Dier couldn't see the ball. He was facing the other way.
Yeah, I'm well aware of that. I wasn't aware of that little stipulation in the law, that because that would suggest that the penalty should not have been given. There's also the question of, you know, are these clear and obvious errors that are being overturned? I would suggest they are not. It was a pretty clear and obvious error to sort of give the penalty in the first place, but that's what referees have been told to do. I suppose this whole thing is, do we want consistency or do we want common sense? At the moment, we're getting consistency, but it's ridiculous consistency, consistently wrong in inverted commas decisions. Ideally, we would go for common sense, but I think recent events outside the world of football have shown us that there isn't a huge amount of common sense to go around. So.
But I would argue that there wasn't. You're not even getting consistency. Like, Joel Ward had two handballs that weren't handballs, and one was given and one wasn't. Eric Dier, basically, Andy Carroll headed one into Eric Dier's hand about a minute earlier, and we were like, oh, thank God that wasn't given. And at the other end, Ndombele kicks it into Lascelles' hand, and it's away from his body, not above his shoulder. I wouldn't want a penalty for that either, but...
Also, Chelsea's equalising goal was scored with the help of an actual handball. But because there was like 0.7 of a second rather than 0.3 of a second between that and the goal being scored, that was not deemed a handball.
But I hate myself for even saying this, but I'm going to push my spectacles up my nose here and go, I think you'll find that in stipulations introduced, I think back in April, it was agreed by IFAB that the Havertz handball wouldn't count as a handball because it didn't lead directly to a goal. That the ball...
Well, it did lead directly to a goal. A goal happened 0.5 of a second later. And if that handball hadn't happened, there wouldn't have been a goal. That's cause and effect.
No, I agree with you. But their logic, or lack thereof, is that because someone else touched the ball before the ball reached the goal scorer and went into the net, then it shouldn't count as a handball. I'm not agreeing with what they have stipulated. I'm just saying what they have stipulated.
I mean, at the end of this, we have this ludicrously expensive video system with people in a room literally staring at screens as though this is a kind of Cold War bunker controlling the world. And that doesn't get ruled out and some stupid thing is a penalty and we all have to talk about it. I mean, it's just absolutely pathetic, the entire thing. And it just confirms what we've already known for hundreds of years, that everybody involved in running football is incredibly stupid. And here is proof. The only thing VAR establishes is that everybody is incredibly stupid. And we can see that in replays time and time and time again. It's weird. Where are the intelligent people? Where are people who aren't massive egomaniac? Why aren't they involved in this somewhere?
Steve Bruce said, football has lost the plot with handball. It's a total nonsense. The decisions are ruining the spectacle. Roy Hodgson said, I do not understand how we've allowed the law to come into the game. It's destroying my enjoyment of the game of football and nonsense ruining the game. Mark, you enjoying the pod?
It's been great, yeah. It's just like normal Mondays, just listening in. I mean, if Steve Bruce felt that angered by it, he could have always ordered Callum Wilson to have missed the penalty or allowed Tottenham to go at the other end and sort of retake the lead. I mean, I thought Roy Hodgson actually did speak a lot of sense about what sort of handball is and how it's, you know, just not a difficult rule to interpret, in the fact that if it's deliberate or you gain an advantage, then it's handball. And if it's complete accident, then it's not handball. And that seems to be quite a sensible way to sort of, you know, move the handball law on. So you could argue that if sort of Eric Dyer did that, you know, on the goal line, you know, with his, where he couldn't see the ball, then maybe it would be a penalty because there's a massive advantage to stopping it. But in those instances, you are now going to get teams looking to head the ball onto the arm of an opponent because it's impossible for Andy Carroll to score in that situation, but it's not that difficult to head the ball onto the defender's arm.
What do you think will happen, Barney? Do you think anything will happen this season, or are we lumbered with this nonsense for the whole season?
I don't know. I mean, there's a sort of practical and sort of philosophical difficulty with changing the rules midway through the season, isn't there? Because then people feel it's not fair because, you know, all we ask for is consistency, to use a phrase people like to use. It's very hard, isn't it? I mean, there's a logic to the rule and it's being applied logically. So you could argue there's no need to change it. The objection is that it's somehow against the spirit and the kind of practice of how football has always been. It's just a sort of really depressing thing that this has happened at a time when there are no crowds. And football's become this kind of really weird digital product, which is now completely dominated by television replays. It's literally becoming a computer game. And that's a really odd thing to watch happening. I think when people like Roy say it's, you know, he looked really sad. He looked really upset and depressed. And this lifelong love of his football has now been ruined. And I think probably he's speaking to the fact that he's in an empty stadium. And it is weird in those empty stadiums without the fake crowd noise, watching this activity that's now run by people with cameras arguing over absolute inanities. And I just don't think if you pitched football as a thing, this is what it's going to be. We'll be in this empty stadium and we'll argue for ages about whether a ball hit someone's hand. You wouldn't get past the first pitch. I said, no, don't do that. That sounds terrible. Get rid of the arguing about the handball bit, put some fans in, and then we might have a spectator sport. Because right now it isn't good and it doesn't look good and it's kind of draining the joy.
Yeah, I totally agree. I Barry, do you think, I mean, it really not just because I wanted Tottenham to win, but, you know, watching the Joel Ward one or even the Mopai one, which you could argue was slightly more handball because his hand was up, but even still, it makes me not enjoy football as much.
I wouldn't go so far as to say that personally. I mean, I don't care who wins a game.
I thought you'd say you didn't like it in the first place.
But, you know, the outcome of those games are not something I'm overly concerned about. I don't care who wins. I enjoy the spectacle. I enjoy the drama. And a certain part of me enjoys the controversy. I thought it was absolutely hilarious that Spurs got done like that. The fact of the matter is they should have won that game comfortably. And I was actually surprised by how well Jose Mourinho took it, because I thought he'd be absolutely seething. And he was uncharacteristically philosophical about this terrible decision that went against his team and cost them 2 points. But my understanding is that these IFAB people will be having one of their secret meetings in October, and perhaps something will come of that, because I think the outcry is reaching such a crescendo that they will be forced to make some sort of adjustment to the rule.
And now there were actually football matches as well, so why don't we talk about them? Let's start at the Etihad. Manchester City 2, Leicester City 5. Sam says, please, I beg of you, talk about how good Leicester were. I know Barry hates us and will want to ignore us and talk about Manchester City. But it's time to stand against your oppressors and give Leicester the airtime they deserve. You can do it, Max. I believe in you. I didn't know you were at Leicester were amongst the teams that obviously the ones we know that you hate, Barry, but there you are. I thought they were great, weren't they? And Jamie Vardy was superb, Baz.
Yeah, I actually am coming around to the way of thinking that he doesn't get the credit he deserves. And I think it's because he's English, he's not foreign, and he looks like Albert Steptoe. I suspect that doesn't do him any favours. He's so intelligent as a footballer, and, you know, he got two penalties yesterday. I think won both of them, scored two. And his little back heel flick at the near post from the was it Timothy Castagne cross was just unbelievable. So despite his advancing years, he's what, 33 now, he doesn't seem to be slowing down at all. And he seems to be just getting more and more clever. I don't know if that's the Brendan Rodgers influence or just him as a player adapting as he gets older.
I mean, Barry, it's pretty impressive that you can pick out the guy who scored a hat trick as this underappreciated star player. And you know, that, you need an eye for that kind of thing. And I am impressed. But I don't mean to go on about City, but I think they made Wolves look pretty good as well. I mean, I was at the game at Molyneux last week, and they were so vulnerable for 20 minutes there. They could have easily, that game could have really turned around. And I thought, what Leicester did really well is they watched the right bits of that game and thought, right, well, we can really get at this team as well. And it's astonishing how vulnerable City look when someone as good as... I mean, Vardy's just made for them, absolutely made for them. He totally destroyed Eric Garcia. It was kind of incredibly unpleasant. I don't know about you, but it did something strange to me. At times, it was almost as though Garcia was wearing a rugby scrum hat. He'd been so traumatised. I'm sure it was just my eyes playing a trick on me. That can't have really been happening. There was a point where Garcia was in his rugby scrum hat, jumping up and down with his hands behind his back while Vardy scored a goal, which was probably the most emasculated any football player has ever been. It was, you should just never come back when that's happened to you. It was terrible. But Leicester actually really went for the jugular. And I think it was the worst City performance. I mean, could you say it's the worst City performance of the Sheikh's era? It was pretty terrible. Five goals at home, having led. I mean,
didn't they lose 8-1 to Middlesbrough once? I mean, I can't remember if that was during the Sheikh's time.
I think, Sven Goran Eriksson's last game in charge.
That would have been pre-Sheikh. Right. Okay. I mean, if you're including pre-Sheikh, then there are lots of bad City performances to choose from. Jamie Vardy, the only player to score a league hat-trick against a Pep team. He has two hat-tricks against them. This is the first time a Pep Guardiola side has conceded five in his 686 games as manager. Leicester, the first side in Premier League history to score three penalties in a single game. And they go to the top of the league. It's interesting, Mark, because before the season started, everyone went, oh, yeah, Leicester didn't end the season well, haven't really done that much in the transfer window. I think they might struggle.
Yeah, those were my thoughts exactly. And then going into the game when Ndidi was ruled out, I thought that, you know, he would be a massive absence in a game like that. But even without sort of, you know, Maddison only came on and scored a brilliant goal, but, you know, he'd been very key for them and influential in the first part of last season. And I didn't think Leicester played very well for the first 30 minutes, actually. It wasn't until they had like one half chance, and that seemed to give them a bit of belief that, you know, Man City were there for the taking. But, I mean, just the amount of goals that Vardy scores against Man City, I mean, surely a guy is clever, and some say he's too clever for his own good, in fact, in Pep Guardiola. Why doesn't he just drop the defence back a little bit to negate that space that Vardy loves so much? I mean, if you're that clever, surely that's what you do.
That's a really good point. I was thinking the same thing. With managers, I'm really loath to say, oh, Arsene Wenger's an idiot. Why doesn't he do that? You know, they always know more than you do. They always know what their players are feeling like, how they woke up. They know everything. We just see the outside. But then there's this weird crossover where you suddenly think, actually, he doesn't know the thing that is really obvious. And I felt that with Guardiola maybe for the first time. Like, why? Well, not for the first time. It happens with him quite a bit. But like Mark says, it's like, why aren't you doing this really obvious thing? How can I know that and you don't? And it happens very occasionally. And I'm loath to believe it. I'm sure there is some reason that you know nothing about where he has to keep doing this. But it was a very weird sort of Oedipal moment where suddenly the manager looks small and confused.
Are their defenders good enough? I mean, isn't Ruben Dias apparently coming in from Benfica for 65 odd million pounds? But you sort of look at that back four and you think, shouldn't they have a better back four given that they've had a shake with loads of money for this much time?
Well, they bring in these expensive defenders and they don't seem to be able to adapt to, I don't know, as a Pep style of play or a Pep system, but Nathan Ake didn't look up to much yesterday, and, you know, he was their big acquisition and apparently going to be the source of all, or the solution to their problems. He's not the first defender they've brought in who's failed to adapt. Now, admittedly, they did have injury problems yesterday. Aymeric Laporte is out, and both strikers, first-choice strikers, were missing, or first- and second-choice strikers. So they are kind of extenuating circumstances, but a lot of Leicester players were outstanding. Castagne, James Justin, Harvey Barnes, Papi Mendy. I have to say, actually, hats off to Papi Mendy, who capped an outstanding performance with one of the most footballery post-match tweets I've ever seen. So it's a massive win today, rocket taking off emoji. Great performance from the lads, handshake emoji. Keep going on, fist bump emoji, wink emoji. Hashtag Man City Leicester, hashtag Leicester City, hashtag Premier League, hashtag match day, hashtag Leicester, hashtag let's go.
I did really love this tweet from Andy on the subject of Liam Delap, obviously. And Andy saying, every time I heard Delap's Nova City, I couldn't help but think of when Rory Delap's mere presence rattled Boaz Myhill to the extent he would rather boot it out for a corner than concede a throw-in. Possibly the moment that best encapsulates the Barclays Premier League for me. It's I tweeted out yesterday. I should also mention Riyad Mahrez's finish was absolutely sensational, wasn't it? I mean, that the ball stayed ball. What an absolutely glorious hit.
And with his right foot. Imagine a two-footed footballer. It's incredible.
I know. Also, what was quite fun with yesterday's game, and as we're hearing a lot, it's just the number of times the commentators have to apologise for swearing. It's getting really sensational. There's one, I think, where the camera just cut to Andy Carroll, and, you know, parental advisory, he just went, fuck me, man. And then poor old Rob Hawthorne had to again go, sorry, have you heard someone swearing again? Fred said, had Barry stopped laughing at Chelsea before he started laughing at City? West Brom 3, Chelsea 3. Since the start of last season, Chelsea have conceded more away Premier League goals than any other team. Mark, is this a great comeback from Chelsea? Is this West Brom throwing it away, or is this a fair result?
I think it might have been a fair result, actually. I don't feel like West Brom threw it away. They only had three shots on target in the entire match. They would have taken a point beforehand. And even in the first half, when Chelsea were all over the place, they still created opportunities. Tammy Abraham should have scored. Timo Werner might have scored as well. So I don't feel like West Brom chucked it away as such. But, I mean, it's been mentioned on the pod sort of many times before about sort of Chelsea's defensive deficiencies that they've, you know, can't seem to solve, and it was just such a lax sort of first half performance. Alonso does that far too often, really, to be playing for a team that's got ambitions of winning sort of significant trophies. Thiago Silva had that sort of real off moment as well, but the first half from Chelsea just felt like a bit of a mess, where I'm not entirely sure sort of what formation they were playing or who was supposed to be doing what job. He sorted it out at half time. It was much better after the break, when they sort of got a bit of structure to the team. But the first half just felt like, you know, I'm not quite, where was Mason Mount playing? Was it sort of right wing or something like that? I don't know. Kai Havertz didn't seem to know where he was playing. Timo Werner was in this position sort of off the left that didn't really seem to suit him. So the first half was a mess. The second half was much better.
Two goals for Callum Robinson. Barry, an Englishman who you stole for the Republic of Ireland. It's not all one way, that.
Funnily enough, actually, you mentioned that one of the first things I did yesterday was go and check, is Liam Delap eligible for Ireland? But I notice he's been playing underage level for England all the way through. So it looks like he's another one that got away.
We talked about Matias Pereira quite a lot when we were discussing the Championship last season. He looked quite impressive, and he had one sort of cushioned, back-heeled, volleyed pass that was just a thing of total... You know, when it's you can see they're playing a different game to everyone else. It was a work of genius. Barney, is that Thiago Silva's mistake? Is that Frank Lampard's fault?
Well, he signed him. I mean, I wouldn't have signed Thiago Silva. Thiago Silva is a bit of a mystery to me. I know everyone says he's one of the best centre-halves in the world, but I never quite got it. I just remember being in a room with him in Brazil at the World Cup, and when he was Brazil's captain in a home World Cup, and him bursting into tears in the middle of his press conference, like, without sounding like a kind of appalled Victorian man pointing another man and saying he is weak. It just, at that moment, you just knew they were going to lose 8-1 to someone at some point. I just think he's a really, like a good footballer, but a kind of overrated presence. You know, when you think of those real hard people who just make teams win, I don't think he's one of those. And he's quite old now. Certainly the decision to sign him, make him captain in his first game for some reason, as though that's, he must be the captain. I think it's a bit weird. But I think Chelsea will be really improved when they get their left-back position sorted out. They've got two players who can play left-back or left-wing-back who are injured at the moment and would instantly improve their team, because Alonso is a problem.
I think Lampard deserves a certain amount of credit for that performance and the comeback, and I suppose the poor first half performance. I mean, Chelsea did spurn quite a few opportunities to score in after they went 1-0 down, and I think they showed a decent amount of character to come back from 3-0 down. They could have, you know, folded completely.
Chelsea want Declan Rice. And if that happens, Jorginho would go to Arsenal. Who would you prefer in your team, Barney?
I think they're both good players. I mean, there was a sort of vogue for slagging off Jorginho when he played under Sarri, because Sarri wanted him to pass and pass and pass, and, you know, we don't like that, do we? But I think they're both really good midfielders. I think Declan Rice would improve Chelsea, because one thing he's really good at is finding the right space to stand in to defend counter-attacks and what have you. I think that'd be good business for everyone, really. I think Jorginho would be useful for Arsenal too. Apart from West Ham. Who could probably do some money, I guess, to buy someone else, some other players. Yeah.
Anyway, if they sell one of their best young players, I think everybody will be pretty relaxed and happy about it anyway. That'll do for part one. Part two will begin at the Amex. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Brighton 2, Manchester United 3. Brighton hit the woodwork 1,000 times, it felt like. I think it was 5. Equalised in the 95th minute and still lost. United's winner after full-time whistle had blown, which I guess is what might happen with VAR. But it still feels... I mean, that feels so brutal, Mark. The game is over and you still lose.
There was a game in the Bundesliga when VAR first came in where the players were in the sort of heading into the tunnel and going towards the dressing room at half time, and they had to be dragged out for a penalty. So we are seeing new ways of goals being sort of scored after sort of full time or half time whistles. This felt, I mean, you mentioned earlier on, Max, about the sort of injustice of kind of the Tottenham result and sort of how Newcastle managed to secure that point. This felt even worse in some ways that Brighton managed to lose this game, because they played the vast majority, apart from that Rashford brilliant goal, I mean, nearly all of the good play in the game and the exciting moments came from them. They looked like a team that had been coached better of the two sides. Definitely deserved a draw. In fact, they were probably unlucky not to win the game, never mind sort of be drawing after 95 minutes. And then to lose just felt like real sort of sporting robbery. I just felt so sorry for Brighton after that game. But you know that they're on the right path with Graham Potter, and you know, that structure and the way that he gets them to play, I think, will just reap long-term benefits.
Yeah, I agree with Mark there. There was like an example of a really good coach, Graham Potter, who's made his team, which is quite a recently assembled team, play really well in a good system which suits the players, being beaten by a kind of star machine with some better component parts. It's very hard to argue that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is having any kind of similar effect on the components at his disposal, you know, given how high quality they are. And Graham Potter was really sweet at the end, talking about how sore he felt, but without really blaming anyone, because he saw how well his team played and felt encouraged, because managers tend to look at performances. You did feel a bit sorry for him, I agree.
Chris says, have you ever seen a player so visibly go through an emotional roller coaster as Neil Mopai? Like the face of a kid who's been told they're getting drive-through on the way home from Nan's, expecting McDonald's, only to be greeted by a soggy sarnie from a roadside calf. I thought that Panenka might be my favourite ever Panenka, because I think the height he gets on it, Barry, sort of makes it even more indulgent. I seem to remember Dwight York getting one for Aston Villa that was quite similar, where he's almost brushing the top of the net and still landing low. It was beautiful.
Yeah, I admire his courage for trying it and pulling it off. I'm not sure Graham Potter was hugely impressed, but I actually thought watching in real time that he'd missed. So it was beautiful, and the fact that it bounced before it hit the back of the net as well, I think you get extra points for that. But I thought of all the handball, controversial handball decisions this week, and that one was probably fair enough, because he did throw his hand up as he went to try and block the ball. So but yeah, the fact that it the game had ended when the decision made, it just sort of makes you wonder, is Leandro Trossard at some point going to open his front door and Mike Riley or Kevin Friend will be standing there brandishing a yellow card for some offence he committed, you know, 3 months ago.
But that one was actually logical. I mean, it was a handball, and the right result was arrived at. If it would have been an injustice if that hadn't been given as a penalty. So in a way, that was the system working, even though it seems absurd in the 10th minute of injury time after the game has finished.
Jamie says, who on the panel would be best at the Trossbar challenge? You mentioned Trossard. He hit the left post, the right post and the crossbar in consecutive shots. It really is totally unfair, isn't it?
Well, I think... I mean, him and Solly Marsh missed an awful lot of chances between them. And while I think Brighton thoroughly deserved a point, if not all three from that game, their lack of cutting edge up front is an ongoing problem. It was a problem for the last season, and it appears to continue to be a problem for them this season. You could possibly chalk that one down to bad luck, but... yeah, hitting the woodwork. And they weren't even like skimming the woodwork or the outside. They were like really rattling the crossbar, rattling or thumping the foot of the post. So on another day, they could have had 5 or 6.
Interesting with Solly March, in that one of those players that you have to say his full name. At no point can any commentator just say March. It's always Solly March. I don't know if there's any reason for that. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer said, look, we're not sharp enough to get out to stop the crosses or follow the runs. We need more late goals. This is a great boost for us. Barney, where do you sort of assess where Manchester United are? We talked about it on the last pod, and some United fans were a bit annoyed at us for not going into sort of the systemic issues of the Glazers' ownership structure, which... arguably, we could have done, but we can't do it every week. But how? Where do you assess where they are?
They are where they are, aren't they? I mean, it was really strange. The kind of summer season, the overspill bit, you saw stuff happening there. It was like a training camp for them, and you saw the attacks start to work and the midfield start to look quite good. But they, a bit like Man City, the defence can look okay, but can also look as though there are individuals in it who just aren't quite good enough. And I think probably if you gave them a really, really good manager who could make them... I know, you know, Solskjaer's done okay, but is he the right person to be managing Man United? He kind of... he looks increasingly... My son said to me he looks like a sad old toy on a shelf, you know, like sort of sat on the shelf in like a kid's film. Like he's got this kind of mournful, I don't think he feels under any pressure in the job, which is a really good thing. And I think he can make quite unaffected, quite good decisions involving his players, which is, you know, there's a sort of simplicity what he does. It's quite good. But I did enjoy Marcus Rashford's goal. I mean, he's an academy player. He's come through that team, scored a goal that just showed his many brilliant qualities. And you see things like that and you think, well, this is a healthy team, you know.
Sure. And the pass from Fernandes as well was, I mean, glorious, wasn't it?
Yeah, we have to talk about Bruno Fernandes. He's, you know, it's compulsory.
We also have to talk about Paul Pogba, who was diabolically ineffective in his sort of, well, it's a role I suppose he's not accustomed to playing in too often, but he's just way too inconsistent, and you think they need to get rid.
Okay, I'll see what I can do. Barry, would you be slightly happier if he became slightly more consistent? So instead of a 4 out of 10 and a 9 out of 10, you just got solid 7s from Pogba. Do you think that would affect your happiness?
I'm not sure anything Paul Pogba could do, apart from deposit £5 million in my bank account, would affect my mood in any way whatsoever. But I'm here to offer opinions on Manchester United. Brighton, that was one of them. I'm now sorry I bothered.
Let's go to the London Stadium. West Ham 4, Wolves 0. Now, definitely last pod, and we've done this. I think we did this exact same thing the previous season. We looked at West Ham's fixtures and decided they're not going to get 3 points for the next 5 months. And then suddenly, they just last season, I think they just went to Goodison Park and hammered Everton. And this time, they just obliterated Wolves in like a utterly, bizarrely one-sided game. And I don't know where it came from, Mark.
I don't know if there's recency bias here, but I put down in my notes, it's the best I've ever seen West Ham play. So
whatever, ever.
Yeah. I mean, I just can't remember them ever controlling a game. Like, you know, they have like really... have good results every now and then. There's a sporadic kind of, you know, they'll just go and beat Chelsea or something, but it's often in a chaotic way, and you know, end to end, and then they might end up on the right side of it. But this was against the Wolves team, they're still, you know, among the stronger in the Premier League. You maybe not sort of top four, but certainly below that. And they played so well. They controlled Wolves for virtually the entire 90 minutes, looked dangerous when they were going forward as well. And having scored 5 against Hull in midweek, maybe there is something in David Moyes just staying away for a little bit longer and just allowing this team to be micromanaged by Stuart Pearce and the other guys. This I just thought West Ham, sort of joking aside, that they were really good. And they had shown signs against Arsenal. It was a much improved performance. But from where they were against Newcastle a couple of weeks ago to that, amazing transformation. I thought they were just so good.
It was really good to see Stuart Pearce using the last known landline to be on the phone to David Moyes during the game about something or other, Barney.
Yeah, I mean, I'd quite like to talk to Stuart Pearce on the phone during a game. I imagine he's barking things at you. But I fell asleep watching this game late last night. I was sort of drifting in and out of consciousness. And then I kind of opened my eyes and woke up and I saw the face of Nuno Espirito Santo. And I don't know if I imagine this, he seemed to say, "The answer is not in the transfer market. The answer is within." And then they sort of cut away from him. And that seemed to like not, everyone just sort of carried on talking about handball or whatever. But that seemed to me an incredible piece of wisdom and sort of Yoda-ish kind of brilliant soundbite. I'd like to have it as a ringtone. I thought it was a brilliant moment. And he obviously is dissatisfied with something that's going on there with his players rather than his team, which is quite interesting. I also thought I hope that George Mendes didn't hear him say that.
I was going to say, doesn't it lose a bit?
It could be a problem there.
Doesn't it lose a bit of its impact when it comes from anyone connected with Wolves?
Yeah, well, it was quite a revolutionary thing to say, I thought, and you know, George won't be happy. But I agree with him. I think we should all say that more often.
I liked Antonio Fornals and Bowen, Mark. I mean, that... as a three, they looked like they had a real understanding.
Yeah, absolutely. And the team, I think, did function better without sort of Mark Noble as well in that midfield. I mean, he's sort of iconic sort of leader of the team and, you know, supporter and, of course, expert tweeter these days on sort of business affairs at West Ham. But actually, it just enabled them, I think, to get more athleticism in the team in other areas and have that forward threat going forward, because Socek and Declan Rice could sort of handle the midfield on their own. And it was very exciting. And I think Haller coming off the bench and sort of proving that he's not a complete flop as well, having done some good work in midweek, just gives them another option, because they did spend, what's it, about £40 million on Haller, who just didn't do anything last year. So it felt like the sort of turning point really for West Ham. And actually, if you look at their team, it is quite good. And there's no reason really why they should be down in sort of 15th, 16th fighting relegation. I think they should be aiming for top half.
Cue six defeats on the spin. Crystal Palace 1, Everton 2. Everton joint top. Ian says, now that Everton just win every game, does it ever become boring? Barney, what have you made of Everton's start this year?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously good. It's not hard to pick out that they're playing well. And they have a really good manager.
This from a man who belittled me for saying Jamie Vardy played a pivotal role in Leicester's win over Manchester City.
Yeah, I said that with all...
Give us more of your searing insight, Barney. More, please.
Well, yeah, if you listen
Everton
back...
Everton have a good manager, have they?
If you listen back to what I said, as I know you do...
Some good players, eh?
You will see that I acknowledge that point. But... I'm slight James Rodriguez skeptic in that I know he's a brilliant player. Like, I've seen him play in the Fresh, but you know, the Premier League's this horrible place where people do kind of get hold of you after a few weeks, and it is grueling and exhausting. So I'd be interested to see how he's going by Christmas. I wonder how well Carlo Ancelotti would do with the resources at Frank Lampard's disposal. I wonder how well he would manage that team. I wonder what he would do with their attacking riches. I mean, that would be an interesting thing to see. Although I suppose the chances of him having an emotional return to Chelsea are probably fairly small, given the way he departed last time. It's great to watch. I really enjoyed watching.
Another for Dominic Calvert-Lewin. Great build-up play for there. Apparently Everton are top of the iTunes chart currently with you're down with these things, Barney, a song called Spirit of the Blues. I've been besieged with various videos with the music. I didn't know what was going on for a while yesterday, but I got full up. Maybe it's the Everton fans who are still annoyed with me for what I said about James Rodriguez a few weeks ago, to which I humbly take it back. And I please note that Barney has now been sceptical about James Rodriguez. So it's at Barney.
Oh, no, but I'm probably wrong. I mean, I'm always wrong about things. I'd just be very interested to see how he... You know what it's like in the Premier League? People, he's quite small, physically small, not that... He's defying, purely by being very good at football. He's defying the physicality of the league, and long may it continue. But, you know, let's see how it goes.
All right, that'll do for part two. We'll do a bit more on Spurs Newcastle after the break. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So let's talk about the Spurs Newcastle game without the 95th minute then. How, Barry, did Tottenham not win this football match?
I don't know. Just a brilliant performance by Carl Darlow in the Newcastle goal. Kept them in the game, and then they drew with that late penalty they got very late doors. Newcastle, it was one of those games where you can sort of see the point of view of Newcastle fans who are totally against Steve Bruce. Personally, I think they're a little too hard on him, but it's difficult to see what really Newcastle hoped to achieve yesterday rather than beyond sort of grabbing a point through sheer luck. Luck their manager acknowledged after the game. And they play five across the back. They invite pressure. The pressure duly came, and it was just a combination of wastefulness and brilliant goalkeeping that stopped Spurs being completely out of sight by half time.
You know, you mentioned that I think we've talked about Steve Bruce and doing pretty well at Newcastle. I did think watching that, if I was a Newcastle fan, wow, they stunk the place out. I think it's sort of an absolute disgrace that, that they got anything out of that football match. And they just, because they didn't even defend well, Mark. They didn't do anything.
No, this, you used to get this with Jose Mourinho sometimes, where it used to be called like a Mourinho masterclass, where the goalkeeper plays brilliantly. I remember once De Gea doing it for Manchester United at Anfield, and it was a Mourinho masterclass because David De Gea saved about 10 shots. That's not defending well. If the shots on target count, I think it was 12-1 at the end of that game. So, no, Newcastle the closest they came to scoring before the penalty was when Ben Davies kicked the ball against a teammate and it rolled out for a corner. I did feel like Spurs dropped off considerably once Son went off at half time. The second half, there wasn't that flow of chances created. It was controlled from Tottenham, but you know, you do leave yourself vulnerable if you don't get that sort of second goal, and maybe they could have pushed a little bit harder for it in sort of that last 20-25 minutes when they did seem to just believe that one was enough.
You mentioned Son's injury there, and actually quite a few players seem to have strains over the weekend. You know, Vardy sort of pulled his groin, didn't he? And you worry, Barney, that a lot of players may get injured this season.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, absolutely. We're in sort of untrodden ground, aren't we? We don't really know what we're doing to these people, forcing them to run around like this without a proper pre-season, and in ways where probably their fitness coaches have some reservations about it. Obviously, that's got something to do with the goals we've had as well, like the sheer volume of them. I mean, talking of which, I do wonder with Spurs if they're slightly created a team at the moment where there's only really three players in that team and really two in that starting 11 who are going to score a goal. So it seems unlucky. They've had a lot of pressure, you know, but they've somehow not been able to convert these chances. But there's kind of seven outfield players there who just don't really score. So if Harry Kane and Son miss a lot of chances, you're quite likely to be undone by a, you know, weird penalty sort of handball type incident at the end. I don't know if that's a thing, really.
I thought Tanguy and Ndombele looks really fun. Like he seems to play football in a different way to most people playing football, and just moves the ball in a different way I'm excited to see, you know, if he can be fully fit and Jose can love him and they can love each other, that he could really start to do something for Spurs. Leeds won 1-0 at Sheffield United. Patrick Bamford is the first Leeds player to score in his first three top flight appearances for the club. Bielsa, not conceding is a step forward, he said, and Bamford is making our offensive game more complete. Mark, it could have gone either way, this, didn't he? The Leeds keeper made a number of brilliant saves.
Yeah, I mean, Mezier, particularly in the first half, I think from Lundstrom, that was a brilliant save. I mean, Leeds had 9 shots on target, which for a team away from home at somebody sort of defensively disciplined as Sheffield United, that feels like quite a lot, and they probably believe that they did enough, I suppose, to eventually get that win. I like the fact that Bamford is scoring goals, because Bielsa last season just stuck by him so loyally, even when he was missing chance after chance. And it was a nice header, albeit from a brilliant Jack Harrison cross as well. And Harrison's another one, actually, that I'm not sure all Leeds fans absolutely loved him in the Championship, but he seems to be enjoying the step up to the Premier League. And as far as Sheffield United are concerned, I didn't realise until this morning, actually, that O'Connell could be out for the season. That feels like a potentially really big blow for Sheffield United. A very important player for them last year.
Burnley 0, Southampton 1. Danny Ings getting the only goal. Ralph Hasenhüttl says, "We will have Danny for a very long time, and this is all I can say. We must always pay attention that we are more than only Danny Ings. Are Southampton more than only Danny Ings?" Barry?
Yeah, they are, of course. I mean, Danny Ings had to be provided with the ball before he could score, and it was pulled back to him by Shea Adams, who is not Danny Ings. He's a person in his own right and an important, increasingly important member of the Southampton team. I thought Southampton were slightly lucky in this game insofar as Gineppo led with his elbow, nearly knocked out Phil Bardsley. I thought that should have been a red card. I'm not sure he even got a yellow. But Burnley do look to be in trouble, and it was, I suppose, quite telling. Sean Dyche does not appear to be happy at Burnley. He appears to have fallen out with his owner, and he quite pointedly, I suppose you could argue, made no substitutions in this game. You would assume in a bid to let his owner know that he needs new players, and there's some quite inexperienced players and young players on his bench. So I think Burnley are in a lot of trouble.
Was it Phil Bardsley who Wayne Rooney knocked out?
Other way round. Phil Bardsley knocked Wayne Rooney out.
Ah, right, OK. The Monday games, Fulham Villa, Liverpool Arsenal, we'll cover them tomorrow. Can we do Mark Langan's Euro Blitz, Mark? Very quickly, we might do a bit more on them tomorrow's pod, but quite interesting results, especially Bayern getting hammered.
Yeah, Bayern beaten 4-1 by Hoffenheim, ending that long run of wins. Some suggestion maybe they were a bit tired after Thursday's European Super Cup went to extra time where they beat Sevilla. Others have pointed out, actually, that, you know, they lost Perisic, Thiago and Coutinho from the squad that won the Champions League, and maybe they've just left themselves a little bit light. Lewandowski started on the bench in the game, but also Hoffenheim are an improving team. Kramaric used to play for Leicester, being on fire since he returned from injury. Borussia Dortmund, though, had already lost earlier on at the weekend, 2-0 beaten by Augsburg. So, yes, some big upsets in the Bundesliga. Not so much in La Liga, where Atletico Madrid beat Granada 6-1. Luis Suarez came off the bench and got a couple of goals for them. He's very angry about being let go by Barcelona. So it looks like Atletico could be getting the best of Luis Suarez. Real Madrid won without being ultra impressive. 3-2 away at Betis. Sergio Ramos late penalty, not for the first time in the last couple of years, decided that one. Barcelona, 4-0 winners over Villarreal in Ronald Koeman's first game. I suppose the big talking point there was the fact that he played a 4-2-3-1 formation with Messi as the centre-forward, Antoine Griezmann on one side, Ansu Fati, who was sort of the star of the show, on the other, and Coutinho behind Messi. In Italy, Roma 2, Juventus 2, there were two handball penalties in that game. Ronaldo got a couple of goals for them. And then in France, Paris Saint-Germain were 2-0 winners away to Rennes, and that was Icardi at the double for them.
A nod to the EFL teams with 100% or a 0% record. Reading and Bristol City, Wickham, Derby and Forest on the either end of that scale. In League One, Ipswich, Lincoln and Hull, 100%. Everyone's got at least a point, which is nice. And in League Two, no one's 100% record. Cambridge still top after a fantastic goalless draw at home to Tranmere. Southend, Grimsby, Bolton and Oldham yet to register. Sam says, I went to the University for Foreigners in Perugia many years ago. This is where Luis Suarez went, and where he may or may not have been given his Italian certificate without sitting the test, or before he even sat the test. Sam says, after partying into the early hours one hot summer day, I slept in and missed the exam. After getting back to the UK, my university asked me for the certificate so they could claim the grant I'd received back from the EU. After replying, not untruthfully, that I don't have the certificate, they contacted Perugia and a copy was dutifully faxed over. I'm not sure anything really dodgy goes on there. They're just very bad at admin. Also, Suarez can't utter a word of Italian. Presumably, he nods for yes and shakes his head for no in Spanish, as the words are the same in both languages. And on the subject, Gareth has been in touch to say, regarding Max's team having rolling subs and the possibility of Max bringing himself on temporarily for long throws, I attended a high school match last year in the US and one of the teams had a Rory Delap, who unfortunately was otherwise rubbish. Every time they got a throw in within range of the opposition penalty box, they'd subbed this kid on, even if it meant him having to jog 70 yards to the other side of the pitch to take it. At the next stoppage, they'd haul him off, which at the time meant he had to jog back to the bench and so on for the whole match. 30% of the game must have been spent watching this kid jog on and jog off, and they didn't score from a single one. And finally, a question from William, who says, out of all the Premier League mascots, Liverbird, Wolf, Gunnosaurus, etc., which one would Mark Langdon like to eat?
Oh, that is a tough question, Max. Yeah, that is a really question, yeah. That is a really tough question. It wouldn't. I mean, I know Watford have been relegated now. You wouldn't want to sort of try and take a bite out of him. He's quite feisty, isn't he?
Yeah.
The Spurs one's a bit meaty. Was it the... I've forgotten the name of it now. It's the Cockerel, isn't it?
It's presumably Glenn Cockerel, I imagine.
It's not. Yeah, that Cockerel looks like it could be quite tasty. I'll go for that one.
Okay. And what would you have? What would your sides be?
It's usually potatoes with any kind of meat. So, yeah, potatoes and Yorkshire pudding.
Okay. Good to get a vegetable.
And sausage meat.
Just a slab of it on the top. Good. Stick to the brand, Mark. Excellent. Right, that'll do for today's podcast. I hope you had a nice time. Thank you very much, Barney.
Thanks, Max.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome. Shall I go and ring my doorbell?
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Max.
Okay. Make sure you bring take the microphone to the doorbell or we just hear it. Okay, so here we are. Ladies and gentlemen, finishing the pod with Barry Glendenning's new doorbell.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.